much, Penny. Thank you. Glam out.
Glam out.
Hi, and welcome to The Chat. My name is Leah Summerglue. Each week on The Chat, we shine a light on the lives and careers of UTS alumni here at the 2SER studios. This week, my guest on the show is children's author Deborah Abella. Let's have a listen to her story.
I left school and I didn't know exactly what I wanted to do. You know, I don't know about everyone else, but I sort of vaguely knew what I liked. I knew I liked books. I liked writing. I wasn't sort of kiddie at all then. I wasn't thinking of going into anything to do with children. But I thought, well, maybe telly. I'd like to write for telly. And I don't know what happened. I did a teaching degree instead. In fact, because I was born in the western suburbs of Sydney, and it was at a time where when I left school, there was this real cultural cringe about being born in the western suburbs, and I was a girl from an ethnic family. Western suburbs. Mm-hmm. So it just felt like things added up to say, you're not probably good enough to go to UTS. You know, you're probably not smart enough or brainy enough and certainly not rich. I don't know. And there was just this vibe that if you were born in the Western suburbs, you probably weren't going to amount to much, or, you know, you shouldn't really expect too much. So I didn't. I wanted to apply to UTS and I had the marks and I just didn't do it. And then I did a teaching degree. And after that, I just thought, you know what? I'm too young to teach. I don't know anything. Was I 21 when I finished the degree and I'd trained to be a high school teacher? So I was going to be teaching kids who were like 4 years younger than me. And I thought, I haven't seen anything in the world. I haven't done anything. So I thought, I'm just going to have a little travel. So just a bit of, I'm going to just go and learn stuff. So I went traveling for 3 years. And yes, I ended up, I just stayed in London for a bit and made some friends there and thought, I want to go and see somewhere really different and way out of, you know, creature comforts. Like, and I thought, where would be really different but just simply amazing to go and see? And I saw a truck was going to travel through Africa, and they were like, there's this kind of, I don't even know how I saw it. Maybe it was in a Time Out magazine or something. Who wants to jump on this truck with us? There's going to be about 18 of us. We're going to go on this big adventure through, for, you know, literally we'll drive from London through through Europe and into Spain and then into Africa. Wow. And we're going to travel right down to the bottom. And they used to be quite big. I don't know if they do them anymore. They're just called overland kind of tracks, basically. So we were there for a little, like, loads of things happened. I got thrown in jail a couple of times. I was very cloistered. I was kind of quite a, you know, wasn't a well-traveled kind of person at that point. I was kind of young and inexperienced and didn't know stuff.
Who were the type of people that would that were traveling on these tours?
Yeah, they were largely the truck that we were on, and I'm still one of the people I travel with, is still one of my best friends these years later. A lot of kind of young British kids that were between kind of like uni and working out what to do next, or and some Australians and New Zealanders, and you know, but it was just people kind of thinking, yeah, that sounds great. I have no idea what to expect, but that sounds great. And if you did expect something, it was probably going to be turned on its head anyway, because it was just the most incredible experience. I've had the most frightening times in Africa, but also the most incredible, where you just had the most incredible conversations with people or experiences. We got robbed many, many times. We got harassed by monkeys who threw like poo at us late at night in this campground. We got one very scary time. We were in Uganda and we'd found a clearing to kind of just make a campsite. And Uganda had a feel to it, had a real, like, the ghost of Idi Amin was absolutely still there. And there was there was a very, very uncomfortable feeling there. And so we stayed together and none of us kind of split up and went our separate ways, and we all kind of stayed very close. And so we're at this campsite one night and we saw this truck, the lights of these trucks coming straight towards us. Now we're in the middle of nowhere and there's rumbling down this dirt road, and we thought, is this a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Should we all get in the truck and just drive? Is it, you know? And so these guys got out of the truck, military men with guns, and came, like, left their headlights on. So these, it was such a movie set when I think back to it, in that these silhouettes with guns now are walking straight towards us. And they said, this isn't dangerous. This is dangerous here. It's not safe for you to stay here. You need to come with us. And it's like, is it more dangerous if we go to you? Should we stay here?
Was there a guide or anything? Or was there someone that was just a little bit more well-traveled than you out of the
group? There was the guy who was driving the truck had traveled through Africa for quite a few times. Yeah. But he's, you know, no. The answer's kind of no, really.
So
we
wild.
All just decided, okay, look, they're the ones with the guns as well, and maybe they are. Maybe it's the truth, you know, but I don't know. Who knows? And so we did. We packed up the truck, put tents and stuff back in the truck, followed this truck. And they took us to, you know, down these dirt roads and stuff to suddenly a community centre just appeared out of nowhere, a sort of, you know, glorified, it's got a hut, and said, you will be safe here if you stay here. And it was true. So I don't know where they came from, because they kind of came out of the blue. I don't know. So, yeah, we were safe that night, but... So, yeah, it was great. It was this, like, complete baptism of fire. And what you thought was right was turned on its head. And consequences, because there was corruption, we had to bribe our way out of jail. We had to bribe our way over borders.
Incredible.
it was funny looking back on it now, because I was this kind of puny, didn't know anything kind of kid. But, you know, who could have been very serious, but...
Yeah, no, that's incredible. And so then 3 years later, you come back to Australia?
Yep. I was ready to come back. And then I thought, you know what? I am going to go to UTS.
Yeah.
I want to do it. And in fact, it was better that I did it.
Yeah.
With all of that experience.
With a bit of maturity.
Yeah. So I applied as a mature age student and got in.
After you graduated, you worked in a number of places, but you worked at Cheese TV for a while.
Yes, I did.
I love Cheese TV. How would you explain Cheese TV to someone, I guess, who might not be familiar?
Yeah, it was a morning TV show. It was a cartoon hosting show, which was big when I was growing up. So it's basically a cartoon show, and then between the cartoons, you have hosting segments. So I worked there for about 7 years, and the show was on air for about 10. Mm. I was the assistant producer at first, and then I became the producer when the producer went off to do other things. And there were two main boys called Jade and Ryan, and there was another guy called David Bajaya, who was very, very funny, and another girl called Lenka, who then went on to have a musical career. But it was just, it was mainly the two boys, and we just got to write silly skits. We interviewed people, you know, musicians, actors. We went to London and did stories, you know, at the London Bridge. We went to New York and did stories about the tallest toy store in the world. Like, because we were a kids show, and this was, I don't know if it's still like this, but this is certainly how it was then. It was on Channel 10, and so they had to do kids content. They didn't especially want to do it. Yeah. So they said, as long as you don't break any laws and we don't get too many complaints, you do what you like. So we just went, yeah. And so it was very fun. It was... we met the most incredible people. We'd do like environmental segments and science segments, and we'd do a send up of the X-Files that we called the Cheese Files. You know, it was just...
I remember that.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So we'd look at weird and strange, you know, spooky sort of paranormal stuff. So it was just, we literally could do whatever we liked within the television code of conduct and within kind of, you know, I guess general laws of sort of sanity and decency. So it was really fun.
And your role as a producer, what kinds of things would you do apart from, I guess, you'd be booking guests and
everything,
script writing?
Yeah. So there were just two full-time people, so the producer and the assistant producer. And so you just do everything you need to get that show to go to air. So you wrangle llamas one day, you're booking guests, you're picking up cow poo. You're just writing the scripts, of course. I mean, in some weeks there was so much to do, it'd almost be the 11th hour and you'd think, I haven't actually written a script yet because I've been busy booking, organizing, getting props, you know, getting graphics made up in the graphic department so we could sort of put the guys on a chroma key and then pretend they were at Niagara Falls, or, you know, so it was busy but amazing. Like, it was by the end of the seventh year I was ready for something else, because the show went to air 6 days a week.
Wow.
So it was, in a way, it kind of felt like a conveyor belt towards the end, because you had to you could not have a show not go to air, right? So it's not like, oh, well, can I hand that assignment in late? It's like, no, because black air will go, you know, we can't have dead air, right, on telly. So so it kind of, it was brilliant in that way. In a way, it was the best writing workshop ever because you just had to write. And you couldn't just go, oh, I can't film my muse today. You just, doesn't matter. The muse is out. You got to come up with something.
And from there, then you went into writing children's books?
Yeah, so that...
Was there a catalyst? Did something happen to you?
It was a really happy accident because my first job in telly was working for a company called Southern Star with John Edwards and Sandra Levy. And John Edwards does Offspring and he does Secret Life of Us and just like really incredible shows. And at the time there, I worked with them for a year but for a run of show. So a year of show. And then I came across to Channel 10 and I used to see this person walk past my office and I saw her. I was working in adult drama, just very serious, like way serious working for adult drama. And I used to see this person walk past my office and she'd have armloads of like Mars bars or Easter eggs or toys or twisties. And I'd just think, well, what does she do? Because, you know, I'm not getting any Mars bars on my desk. And so I, you know, chatted and said, oh, so, you know, what's with the armload of toys? And she'd say, oh, I've just started this new kids show called Cheese TV and it's only a couple months old. And she said, actually, I need an assistant producer because I have plans for it. I'm going to make it quite big. Do you want to do it? And it was at a time when I thought, I'm ready for a change. This is a little bit too serious for me, this adult drama kind of business. And that was the first time I'd even thought of working for kids or writing for kids. And when I was there, when I said yes and started on the show, I thought, oh my gosh, this is where I was supposed to end up. Yeah, this is perfect. So yeah, it was an accident that I went to Cheese TV. And then after a few years, I thought, I think I want to write for kids, but long form because the scripts are really short, sharp, tight, you know, tiny segments. Yeah. And I thought, I just want to write a longer story where I get to spend more than 5 seconds working on a script. And so left Channel 10 to become a full-time writer, which horrified my partner at the time.
I was going to say, that's quite a big step to leap into blindly in an area where you've sort of done a little bit of stuff,
yeah,
but not really. How hard was it to write that first book?
Well, see, that's the thing. It was the easiest book I've ever written.
Oh, really?
Because there's no pressure. Yeah. I just thought, you know what? I'm going to – because I did write the first book while I still was at Channel 10, so I was still earning an income, so I didn't have to worry about that. I didn't have to think, well, is this going to sell anything, so I'm going to make any money. So I wrote it, like I took time off. I had a bit of time up my sleeve, and then it took 6 weeks to write. It was really fast. It does not take me 6 weeks to write a novel now. It's really long. I'm getting older and slower. And there was no pressure. I thought, if this gets published, great. If it never gets published, that's okay too. I'd written a novel while I was at UTS just to see if I could do it. And then that's still sitting in a drawer somewhere. It's just to see if I could actually, you know, take a story from beginning to end. And I did submit it. I submitted it to like six of the major publishing houses. I thought, I'm going to go high. Might as well go to the top. And five of them said no, but one of them said, I really like it and I really like these characters. Do you think you can write more? So can this be a series? And that, it went from there.
It's a very promising start.
Yeah, it was a really nice start. It was a really lovely start.
And you sort of mentioned this just then, the skills that you kind of learnt from your previous jobs, did you put that into your writing?
Definitely, yeah. And being a producer, I mean, you just have to do stuff. And there's a deadline every five steps. Yeah. And I've got to meet that deadline. And then you've got to juggle, oh, how am I going to meet that deadline and still do these things and still live and still find time to eat and breathe and see a friend or two? And so it teaches you those balancing skills. And a novel for me is a complete puzzle and a complete balance. And also to be a novelist in this country, unless you're the almost the 5% who earn lots and lots of money for your books, you have to do other things. Mm. So I do teach and I teach writing workshops and stuff. So it's still that juggle to try and
of course
make it happen. Yeah.
You're listening to The Chat on 2SER 107.3. My name is Leah Summerglue and I'm talking to children's author Deborah Abella. How do you find writing for children? Is it challenging trying to get into that mindset, or like, I guess, almost going back.
It's more
into
like
your own childhood.
Yeah, it's more like going back. So it's not even. There's a lecturer who's amazing, and he said once, it's not just about remembering your childhood. You have to somewhere in you still be that kid, and remember what it was like. You know, the first time your best friend walked away from you, or I don't know, something sad that happened to your family, the first time a pet died, or, you know, or also how it felt like to go on holidays or go to your favorite place. So you've got to, in a way, still have that 9-year-old or that 4-year-old or whoever you choose to write for kind of actively inside you still.
Of course. And I've noticed some of your books have sort of come from a personal angle.
Yeah.
Like Teresa, A New Australian, is influenced by your dad. Could you tell me about your dad's story?
I've known this story ever since I was a kid. So my dad was born in a cave during one of the heaviest bombing raids of World War II. And so I've known this. I was born in Western Sydney. I grew up in a regular house, regular backyard, you know, nothing special. But I've always known this story. And when I got kind of older enough, I'd say, so what's with the cave? And what's with the bombing? And why didn't you just go to hospital? And so my dad was born in a tiny country called Malta. So wedged between basically Sicily and North Africa, and both of those places, Europe and North Africa, they were battle fronts in World War II. So Malta found itself right in the middle. Hitler and the Italians decided they were going to take Malta because it would be a brilliant kind of midway point, and they would have this massive physical, geographical and military advantage if they conquered Malta. So they began a bombing campaign. And the Maltese, there were 220,000 Maltese, no military, like nothing to defend itself from the biggest army in the world. So it's this. So what they did was, the Maltese people, they knew they couldn't defend themselves. So what they did was they dug these series of underground tunnels, just massive systems of underground tunnels. So every time the Germans would send their squadrons of planes to bomb Malta, the entire country would disappear underground. And this went on for three whole years, and the Germans didn't win. The Maltese people just refused. They were not going to give up their country. The British very quickly came down to help. So they offered Spitfires and soldiers, and there were some Australian fighter pilots who helped out as well, because the Allies knew Malta couldn't fall because Hitler would just have this massive advantage. So that's the reason my dad was born in a cave, because he was born during one of Hitler's bombing raids.
Wow. And from there, he immigrated to Australia.
That's right. And the great migration of, the 19th, sort of kind of from the 1950s on, the European migration.
Yes. Yeah. And a lot of families as well, you know.
This is the point. Yeah. This is the point. So as, you know, I was thinking about this story more and more, I went to Malta. I thought, I think this is a story because, of course, right now we're seeing the next biggest wave of migration since that time. And when my dad came to Australia, I don't know if your family experienced this as well, but there was just incredible racism and fear, and based on not knowing, right? Because we didn't have garlic or spaghetti, or like, we didn't have anything back then except there was the indigenous population, largely British population, and a kind of small Asian sort of population, but that was kind of it. So all these waves of different people with different accents and languages came out, and it was kind of, you know, in the middle of the White Australia policy.
Exactly.
So it was government policy to keep these people out, but we needed them.
Such a strange time.
Oh my gosh.
History.
But it just made Australia so rich and so amazing. And also,
Absolutely. We
physically and literally needed the population to build schools, roads, houses, you know, like, if we're going to grow and be a country of more than 7 million people. So I wanted to tell this story not only because I think it's just a great David and Goliath kind of story, but it's what we're living now. And when I stand in front of a class of kids, mostly, I will even ask them who was born somewhere else, whose parents were, whose grandparents were. By the time you get to grandparents, very, very often every kid and every teacher in that class, their hands up because we've all come from somewhere else. But of course, you can't just write a story because you get cranky, which I do sometimes. cranky about how refugees and migrants are treated. I thought, I need a good story. So I'm going to tell a story about a young girl and her best friend who lived through this war. So it's kid's eye view. So they're only really, really young when the Germans start bombing. They live in, like, they have to survive by running from the German bombers and surviving in these tunnels. But then after the war, the country's destroyed. So they have to apply to the Australian government to come to live in Australia. But then, of course, when they get here, Teresa faces her own kind of personal war, because there is that racism. There is that, you know, being harassed just because she's different. And so I really, I wanted to tell an interesting story primarily, but I wanted to base it very much on a period of history that is, I think it's being played out again right now.
How do you go about explaining complex issues like migration and racism to children, though?
They get it.
Yeah.
They get it. They get being scared. They get having to leave somewhere that you don't especially want to leave, but it's best for your family. They get being bullied. Like, what kid doesn't get being bullied? They've either seen it, they've sadly been on the end of it. Like, it's about friendship. It's about having to say goodbye, you know, because not everyone Teresa knows gets to come from Australia, is approved as being worthy enough to come to Australia. So I talk to kids. Like, I talk to kids a lot, and I can talk to the most fidgety, like, kind of tough, you know, year six kids. I do only talk to primarily. And they will become silent at this. And I'll say, and then Teresa was bullied, and then she was running down the street and these other kids threw rocks at her and, you know, whatever. And they're silent. And I'll have the naughtiest kid in class kind of say to me, that's not fair what happened to her. And I think, yeah, it's not. Kids have the most amazing sense of justice too, what's right and wrong. So they get it.
That's so interesting. Also, The Remarkable Secret of Aurelie Bonhoeffer.
Ooh, you said it right.
Did
well
I?
Done.
Yeah. It was inspired by your nan, who would tell you a lot of stories when you were a kid. What kinds of stories would your grandmother tell you?
Oh, she was great. So Teresa's actually based on my dad's mum.
Ah, yes.
So my other nana. And yes. This one, The Remarkable Secret of Aurelie Bonhoeffer, yeah, is based on my mum's mum. And she's from Irish heritage. They're just spooked. They just got a lot of ghostly stuff happening, and it just, they would tell these stories like it was, I went down the shop to get some milk, I came home, made a cup of tea, oh yeah, granddad came back last night and sat on the end of the bed, you know, and granddad's been dead for 10 years, and like, that just was, you know, it was just no big deal. And I remember my nana, who was this thin, wiry, kind of like, you know, those Brillo soap pads. That's kind of the hair she had. And she was this wizened little thing where I don't even remember ever seeing her eat, but I adored her. So she wasn't your big, cuddly, cake-baking grandma. She was, in fact, she chain-smoked. So she'd go, you know, and breathe in and take another puff of it. Anyway, sit down, let me tell you this story. And she was just, I just adored her. So she would tell me these stories. So I wanted to write a story about a young girl who's, her and her family own and run this seaside pier amusement park, and the nana lives with them as well. And some of the characters in the story are actually ghosts, some of the circus performers, but they're lovely and they're funny and yeah. So
ghost stories are quite exciting for children as well. I mean, if you think about it now as an adult, you'd want to protect children from such sort of. But I mean, I grew up on reading Paul Jennings, which was all supernatural.
Yeah, there's spooky stuff that goes on there.
Themed and
I, you know, I've met some kids today who watched It. I just think, okay, glad it was you, because it wouldn't be me. And there are some kids who enjoy being scared, enjoyed the kind of that edge of your being terrified. Other kids, of course, and me included, are not especially fond of scary stories. But so I wanted to write a story that was, it did have ghosts in it, but once you got to know the ghosts, it was actually, they were kind of funny and they were smart and in fact help out in this big dilemma that, you know, the characters face. So
that's great. Look, a lot of people seem to think that they can write children's books.
Yeah.
Why do you think that? Why does everyone sort of think they can, you know, pick up a pen and...
It's very, very funny because it is hard. Anyone who's ever written a novel, it's hard, but it's the most incredible, delicious puzzle as well. And at the beginning, when you just can't get all the pieces to fit and you can't get it to work and it's clunking along and it looks ugly and it's, you know, that's terrible. But when things start to fall into place, it's so delightful. It's amazing. But I've had so many people say to me, oh, kids' books. Yeah, I was thinking I might do that when I retire. Or, yeah, I'm sick of my job. I'm sick of working so hard. I want to sit at home all day too in my pajamas. And I just think, okay, but beyond the pajamas and the cups of tea, there's a little bit of hard work involved. And And I think you've got to like kids. I don't know. I think you've got to get them. I think you've got to have such respect for them. I think, and it's like when you're talking about, so how did kids get the story of Teresa and how do you explain these complex arguments? I think kids are really smart. And if you put it in context and you put a human face to it, they get it. I think they can totally understand. But it's a lot of hard work. Some of my novels, so I've written about 25 of them, some are really like naughty kids and they just don't want to be written and they just make me pull and drag every single word out of like stone. And others are delightful. My last two novels were delightful. All the characters came quite easily. I've never had that thing. I remember Craig Sylvie, author of Jasper Jones, saying, oh, it was just like my fingers were moving and I had a muse just come through me and I wrote it down and I just thought, when's my turn going to happen? Craig, can I have your muse? Send it to my house, because I've never had that. It is hard. It is hard, but you've got to really, really want to do it, I think.
Do you think children's literature is having a bit of a renaissance? I mean, it's been a while since Harry Potter was first released, but kids are out there, they're reading still, which is good.
And also, I don't know if you've tried to get a ticket to see The Cursed Child. Like, he's still going, the old Harry Potter, you know. So, and, you know, with the 20th year this year, the 20th anniversary year, it felt as fresh and as big and as loved as ever. And I love it when I meet little kids now who are only 8 saying, have you heard of Harry Potter? And I just think, aren't you sweet? Yeah, a couple times. And I think Australian children's literature is stronger than it's ever been. I think we've got the variety, the depth. We've got gorgeously, you know, beautiful literary kind of children's literature. We've got really just funny, very well written kind of humour for kids. I think we're as strong as we've been. And it's funny, I was talking to some publishers on the weekend who said the Kindle, the ebook kind of merging into the market has affected adult publishing a bit, but not kids. Kids. And certainly not your picture books if
they
you go
like
quite
the
low.
Tactile over the over the actual screen.
Yeah. And kids can often be collectors. If you're a reader, you often can be a collector. So you want that book sitting on your shelf, staring at you as you fall asleep at night. And so kids' books, it's hard, and it is getting tougher. You know, they're businesses. It's not a holiday camp. So they may love a story but think, I don't know how I'd get this past the acquisitions meeting and past the sales and the marketing team to get a green light on it, because the editor can love your book, but if sales say, I just don't know how I'm going to sell that into a bookstore and sell as many copies as we need to cover, you know, all our margins. So that's like, and that does my head in, that talk, but it's the reality of it. You may have written the most beautiful and incredible story, but if they don't think they can sell enough copies, they won't publish it.
Has that happened to you?
Not yet.
That's good.
Not yet. I'm expecting it shall.
When does the future hold? Are you currently working on something?
I've got last year. So I wrote a series of books called Grimsden and New City about it, and that was my crankiness of climate change. So I basically wrote a series of books set in a flooded city with sea monsters and flying machines and girls who were good with swords, and it was my crankiness towards governments doing nothing about climate change, basically. And then I wrote the sequel to that, and then I wrote the Teresa book, you know, set in World War II and bullying and stuff. So I kind of needed almost to go softer for my next book. So I just wrote about this beautiful family and a young girl who's a brilliant speller but incredibly nervous because of something that happened to her when she was young. And her parents encourage her to enter a spelling bee. So it's an Australian national competition. If she makes it to the grand final at the Opera House, that would be great. And so it's about this whole small country town rallying behind this little girl and their family. And it was just felt right. It felt like I just need a heartwarming, go, India, you can do it sort of story. And then the publisher said, once that was out and it seemed to do quite well, the publisher said, would you write a sequel? And I thought, I'm not done with those characters. I could so easily hang out with those really cute characters again. And then the United States bought those two. Yeah, which is really fun too. So those two books will go to the States. And that's a nice boost for your books because, of course, they've got, I don't know, is it 10 times the population that we've got or something? So that's quite cute. So I'm working on this sequel right now. I'm just about to have an editorial meeting to go into the third draft of that.
That was children's author Deborah Bella talking to me on The Chat. That's all for the chat this week. If you like the show, you can subscribe to our podcast via SoundCloud or iTunes or from our website, which is 2ser.com/thechat. The show is produced with the support of the University of Technology, Sydney and 2SER 107.3. I'm Leah Summerglue and I'll catch you next week.